Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
And we are back with another daily podcast, chapter 12 of A Study in Scarlet, the first Sherlock Holmes novel. Pam, thanks for telling us to read this book.
So, Steve, yeah, I wanted to apologize to you personally for this chapter. Horrible, I know. So what'd you think?
I get so emotionally attached to writing and storytelling. I love storytelling, but I get so emotionally affected by it. There's such a big difference between a murder mystery and the passionate and justifiable revenge tale that Doyle is offering us here. When the audience gets no backstory to the character, they do not mourn the loss of that character. But when an author spends so much time cultivating a character, the audience understands that life on such an intimate level that when that life is extinguished, it's personal. We can understand the feelings of all of the protagonists in this story so carefully. We get very little emotion from the story's antagonists, which is pretty normal for storytelling, but we can extrapolate some of their feelings. But boy, yeah, this is a chapter of a book.
It's pretty good writing though, right? I mean, here's the thing. The situation is obviously horrible, but I think you're exactly right that in many of the stories, we're not really going to get this level of backstory. But Doyle is doing some pretty okay writing here, wouldn't you say?
I think so. I think what we've determined is that the Jefferson Hope character is played by a young John Rambo.
And see, that revenge tale certainly goes in a different direction. This is definitely not an American writing this. I think you are right. An American would have, this guy would have gone in and slaughtered hundreds of people because he's an American. Guns a-blazing. This is very British.
And it took a long, long time to get this all set up. So what can we say?
30-year revenge tale. Yes, sir.
He wandered the West like a Bruce Banner, a Hulk. From town to town, he would wander in.
Well, and it is such an interesting, Doyle is pulling together, as we were starting to talk about yesterday, all of these different genres, right? So we do have the revenge story. We have that sort of Western feeling to it, but it is also framed by this very British detective story. And yeah, you're right. It doesn't feel anything like the American writing of the same period. And part of what, again, really marks Doyle's writing skill, I think, is his descriptions of the landscape. And in this chapter, we get these really important details about both the perils and the beauty of the landscape. So let's just starting with the opening. All night, their course lay through intricate defiles and over irregular and rock-strewn paths. More than once, they lost their way, but Hope's intimate knowledge of the mountains enabled them to regain the track once more. When morning broke, a scene of marvelous, though savage, beauty lay before them. In every direction, the great snow-capped peaks hemmed them in, peeping over each other's shoulders to the horizon. You like that, Steve?
Oh, beautiful. That is beautiful description. This is beautiful land. This is a wonderful area that has some very perilous points to it.
And that's exactly what a British person or a person who had not been to the West is picturing the West, this untamed area of majestic beauty. And you drop the human in there. And I don't know, the first time I ever felt like that was when I visited Alaska. And you recognize that, your food at that point, if they would just drop you in this area.
And that idea of the mountains peeking over each other's shoulders, I think that's a beautiful way to describe these kinds of mountain ranges.
Mm-hmm.
Love it.
And then the danger is real. Giant rocks can come rattling down for sure. And then there's the sort of beauty of the new day. As the sun rose slowly above the eastern horizon, the caps of the great mountains lit up one after the other, like lamps at a festival, until they were all ready and glowing. The magnificent spectacle cheered the hearts of the three fugitives. and gave them fresh energy. And so you've got this notion, Hope is the one who knows where he's going, but all of them have a lot of optimism. They feel like they've escaped. It also reminds you that the beauty and energy of the new day, that means that night is very scary.
Mm-hmm. Well, they also, it's mentioned somewhere that they feel like they're being followed. So even when they're set up the fire at some point, they're kind of hiding it away a little bit.
They are fugitives. They are on the run, and they really feel like they are being followed. And spoilers, they are.
Steve, you're giving it away.
Sorry. Well,
and it's funny because Hope starts to feel a little better, right, as they get further and further away. Because at first he's really like, oh my gosh, they're right on her tail. You can't stop for breakfast. Keep going. And then he starts to feel a little better. But the narrator doesn't allow the reader to share that optimism. He little knew how far that iron grasp could reach, or how soon it was to close upon them and crush them. And of course, we know that because, of course, we're reading this backstory as part of a detective story in which Jefferson Hope is a killer, right? But it's a reminder. Oh yeah, see how they're feeling? They're in this beautiful place. They're feeling okay. Someone will crush them.
that imagery of the iron fist coming for them to crush them. This is wonderful writing from Doyle. We are definitely emotionally engaged here. Doyle uses animal imagery again, but here it's a little more subtle than usual. The quote is, "The bighorn, for so it is called, was acting probably as the guardian over a flock which were invisible to the hunter." We've got some interesting parallels here. Jefferson Hope is the protector of his little flock, while Brigham Young is the protector of his. And this image of the hunter and the invisible people that are trying to not be slaughtered. This is wonderful imagery.
Well, he's hungry at that time too, Steve.
Yes, he needs a sandwich.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because Hope is an excellent hunter. We're told that many times, and we see this. We see him quickly kill the bighorn. He quickly makes a good decision, butchering it, takes how much meat he needs. He can only carry so much, whatever. And he's the protector. I love that connection you're making, especially with the Christ imagery that comes with flocks. Mm-hmm. But he gets lost.
Right? Absolutely.
And so that, you know, it's interesting because I kind of wonder, this man devoting the rest of his life to revenge here, I mean, is part of it guilt, right? Like, he was supposed to be protecting them, and part of that is getting food for them. But at the same time, he got lost. He ended up being away for 5 hours, and he ends up getting back to camp not mid or late afternoon, but early evening, and he is too late.
Yeah.
We see this sort of, can't remember which book, maybe book 2, The Lord of the Rings, where they set up camp on top of some area and they light a fire and they go, no, don't light it. Don't invite the, the rats or something to come to them. The fire certainly could have been a beacon to the people who were tracking them to come get the daughter and the father.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's exactly what happens. They are found. They are taken. He finally finds the camp deserted after his 5 hours of frantically trying to find his people, his flock. And the quote is, "Bewildered and stunned by this blow, Jefferson Hope felt his head spin around and had to lean upon his rifle to save himself from falling. He was essentially a man of action, however, and speedily recovered from his temporary impotence." This is heartbreaking. This is great emotion that Doyle is giving us here. And boy, is it hard to read.
And then he does exactly what Holmes would have done, because he's a hunter. He picks up a smoldering piece of firewood and starts reading the campsite. He sees there's been a large party of mounted men. He is looking at the tracks. He's reading what has happened. And then, of course, he sees the grave. And on top of the grave is a little piece of paper, like on a little cross stick. John Ferrier, formerly of Salt Lake City, died August 4th, 1860.
Hope is a skilled hunter. He is a skilled person who certainly can lead you through the wilderness. Even he gets lost in this wild area. And so, it just shows that even the most gifted people are tamed by this wilderness area. So I could absolutely understand, what the emotions he was going through during this time.
Mm-hmm. Doyle lays that out for us so well. We have an understanding of that so clearly on this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the good news is that we get to do the math on 1860, right?
Yes.
So our question of how old is Lucy is finally solved here.
So we're 13 years after the Exodus. So 13 years later, she would be 18 years old.
All right. So everybody really, this collective, thank goodness.
We're 27 years before the current date of publication, which is approximately when the Watson Holmes story is happening. So what did you guys think of Jefferson Hope finding a grave? Like, why do you think the Mormons didn't just leave John Ferrier there? Why would they bury him and even mark his grave?
All right, so I don't have a definitive answer on that.
But
I do think that in the Mormon tradition, and in fact, they work real, real hard. They believe everyone can get to heaven, right? It's very important to them to create this large database of genealogy, basically to get to heaven. And they have an incredibly large database of, I guess, humans.
Since my wife is very deep into the genealogical community, our trip to Salt Lake City is certainly on the docket for the very near future. Because yes, the LDS genealogy records are known worldwide for their real honor of these people. So the honor that is given to this guy, even though they were hunting him, even though they disagreed with him, they still honor him by burying him and giving him a marker, which is notable.
Well, they want to ultimately save the departed is really what it comes down to.
Well, and I think that is also, it's part of the Western tradition too, right? So that if you have bested one of your foes, you still respect the body enough to bury it and not leave it for the wildlife. And okay. So I do feel like that's coming out of all of these things. There's a religious aspect, but there's also a sort of just a Western feeling to that.
The Western code.
Exactly. Sure. Code of honor. Right.
That's right. Right. So at this point, it seems like Jefferson Hope is going to go Rambo and march right back into Salt Lake City, get the girl, and maybe, American guns ablaze and Western hero here.
But you guys, isn't it interesting that he doesn't do that and he doesn't even think about doing? That's what I found so interesting, is that he goes through many emotions, right? And like Doyle goes deep, really focalizing through Jefferson Hope. First of all, he goes through despair. Mm-hmm. As the young fellow realized the certainty of Lucy's fate and his own powerlessness to prevent it, he wished that he too was lying with the old farmer in his last silent resting place. So he has these thoughts like, I might as well be dead. Then we see his resilience. With indomitable patience and perseverance, Jefferson Hope possessed also a power of sustained vindictiveness, which he may have learned from the Indians amongst whom he had lived.
Mm-hmm. There's Doyle again giving us a group. Here's what this group does. That is very prejudice of Doyle here.
Right.
And he didn't give him a tribe, Steve. He just named it just as strictly as Indians.
All of them. All of Canada does this, and all of the Indians right. do that, and every Greek woman is like this. Yes, that is very, very obvious here, Doyle. That's thank you.
19th century writing. True. And then he goes from despair to resilience to revenge. I don't feel like we ever see hope. And with revenge, he said, as he stood by the desolate fire, he's still in the campsite, he felt that only one thing could assuage his grief would be thorough and complete retribution brought by his own hand upon his enemies. And I'm thinking, okay, you're like 2 to 3 hours behind these guys. They've taken your horses, so you're on foot. So it's not like you're not going to catch them. But like, go to town and swoop in and rescue the girl, man. I mean, it's already a done deal in his mind. There's no hope left, only revenge.
He's not Princess Leia here.
This is, again, this is so British. This is so counting your minutes and waiting and waiting and waiting a darn near 30 years to reap your revenge instead of the American going in there guns ablazing and making the story end.
Yeah. Now, after those 5 days that it takes him to travel back to Salt Lake City, we get again that emphasis on the traffic of women that we saw in the previous couple of chapters. The Mormon sentry explains what's happened. There was some words between young Drebber and young Stangerson as to which was to have her. They'd both been in the party that followed them, and Stangerson had shot her father, which seemed to give him the best claim. But when they argued it out in council, Drebber's party was the stronger, so the prophet gave her over to him.
Well, that's got to feel comforting. Jesus.
It's sickening, and Doyle is certainly laying it out for us to be sickened by this concept of the prophet decided that because this guy had more power or had more money or whatever, he was the right person to take control of this woman's life. That's just sickening.
Exactly. And it's written in order to be sickening. Yeah.
Correct.
And then when Lucy dies within the month, we get confirmation of what our friend John Watson thought the day that he looked down at Enoch Drebber's dead body and thought, I'm almost glad that guy is dead. We were like, yes, John Watson, you were right. Because when Lucy does die, Drebber doesn't grieve, but his other wives do. What did you think? What did that make you think? Remember, he had the... Was he the one with seven wives?
Well, I was going to say, the first thing we should know is that she got married, but she basically willed herself to die. That was right. The first part.
Yes.
But the second part is that in death, many religions have ceremonies on how to do it. And this must be the Mormon version of it. Jews mm-hmm. have a grieving ceremony for death, too. And mm-hmm. I'm sure other religions do, too. It looked to me like the women were performing the mourning ceremony they had.
And then Jefferson Hope sneaks back into Salt Lake City during the mourning ceremony, and he steals Lucy's wedding ring. She shall not be buried in that, he says. And then we begin the chase, cross continents, the chase for revenge.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
A 30-year chase across all of the United States and then all of Europe till he finally catches up with them in London.
Mm-hmm. I was immediately going, there's different thoughts on revenge because it really is at that point becomes a revenge tale. And we know how this ends. We were given to that in the first part of the book. And so I use what I usually do, quickly look up and see what I can find. And what I found was there's two thoughts on revenge. There's the first one, there's the one from the Bible, the Exodus 21-23, instructs, if you're going to, eye for an eye, those types of revenge, tooth for a tooth. And then later on, Martin Luther King sort of responded to that and said the old law of an eye for an eye leaves everybody blind. And for Jefferson Hope, there's no doubt this man has been blinded by what has happened. He becomes on a single mission. So that means that when he goes and eventually hits the different cities and picks up, work because he has no money left and has to put himself in position to be able to follow these characters who eventually be murdered. He is on a single mission, and for 30 years. I mean, that flame does not die. He is blinded by and consumed by revenge.
Right.
Yeah.
And it'll be very interesting to go back to Watson and Sherlock and to get their take on that excellent question. Was Jefferson Hope's action a correct response to this? It's going to be really fun to get back to London and see what they think, because don't forget, this is book one, and we have seen Sherlock and John make some decisions about what counts as justice.
I did think of that. I did think of that. Is there enough backstory that Doyle is giving us to justify that final moment where Sherlock goes, well, yeah, he can go to America. Just send him back to, you know, New York or something.
Well, as long as he's on a boat tomorrow morning, you know.
They did have him arrested. The police are involved. So
yes.
Is he even in a position to make that judgment this time? I'm interested to find out. That's right.
This also makes the idea of Jefferson's, so he's brought up, and they tried to restrain him as he jumped out the window. And then they had to wrestle him down to tie his feet. You know, revenge was one thing. But anyway, he's consumed by it. It was more than just a single person bringing him down.
Or
who would stop him.
Right. All right, which brings us to the chapter ending. So we get the details about several European cities that Jefferson chased the two men. At the Danish capital, he was again a few days late, for they had journeyed on to London, where he at last succeeded in running them to earth. As to what occurred there, we cannot do better than quote the old hunter's own account, as duly recorded in Dr. Watson's journal, to which we are already under such obligation. End of chapter. So we are going to get the old hunter's own account. So we're going to find out what Jefferson Hope says to young Sherlock Holmes and his friend Watson, as recorded by Watson himself. We're going back. We're going.
Oh, good. We're going back to
back
London.
To the future.
It's going to be rainy and cold.
Back to the future. 30 years from now.
Is that a fun chapter?
No, this was really good writing. And the symbol of really good writing is I was emotionally tied to these characters so strongly that I don't want to read this book no more.
Two chapters to go, man. We got this.
Okay. All right. We'll get to chapter 13 tomorrow and find out the perspective from the future, from Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, and see how they feel about all this. If they see all of this backstory, if they know all of this intimate detail that we know now, and see how they settle all this. I hope everybody's enjoying this. I hope you're having fun out there. I hope you're being safe and keeping everybody that you love safe and happy. Not by reading this, but that's okay. Maybe you could read something that'll make you happy while you're out there. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflug.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
Where's my sandwich? That'll make me feel better.